Hello and welcome to Freudian Quips, a WPRK 91.5 FM radio show dedicated to promoting mental health awareness through the examination of popular culture and global current events. I'm your co-host, Dr. Samuel Sanabria.
And I'm Dr. Derek Palladino. And today we have a very special guest, and we welcome Marnie Davis. How are you, Marnie?
I'm good, thank you.
We're excited to have Marnie here. She was she's an alumni of the Rollins College Clinical Mental Health Program a few years back, and she has an MA in clinical mental health counseling. She's a licensed mental health counselor. She has a private practice, which she's going to talk about in a little bit. She's also a certified eating disorder specialist and an EMDR certified.
Almost certified. Yes.
But you've gone through most of the training and now are in supervision.
Yeah, yeah, I'm just in those last 2 hours of supervision to be certified.
Great. Yeah. Great. And today we're going to be dedicating our episode to disordered eating. And why don't we just have you kind of start and tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
I am in private practice. I'm joined in with a group of wonderful colleagues under Personal Solutions and Counseling. We're all our own individual companies or, you know, practices, but we all work underneath the same umbrella and work together. Prior to being in private practice, I worked at Blue Horizon Eating Disorder Services. I started there upon graduation and gained such fantastic expertise and practice skills while working there. Blue Horizon has a very comprehensive program, so I was able to learn all different angles of working with clients with eating disorders and working with a comprehensive team. So I'm very thankful for my work there, and it set me up really nicely to be able to work in private practice now.
And Marnie, sometimes you have students come into the program that aren't really sure about the populations they want to work with or the type of counseling or therapy they want to do, but it sounds like you came in already knowing that.
Yep, I did. I had an idea. I was a school teacher before I changed careers and became a counselor, and I was a health teacher, so I got to really talk with students about all that was going on in their lives, and it was interesting how much dieting and body image and hating themselves and trying to manipulate their weight and body came up in our conversations. And so I saw there was a great need for more healing and help for those who were struggling with those issues. And then myself, being a female, which the epidemic has been primarily focused on females, although as we'll talk today, it is not just a female disease. But growing up and being a dancer, I was a performer, I was a cheerleader, I was an athlete in other sports too. And so I struggled with my own body image issues and trying to manipulate weight before recitals and, you know, struggled with the underlying feeling of maybe not being as good enough as others. And that's what I found is one of the core issues that comes up with most of the clients I work with. And so we learn if we can shift our body a little bit or change that, then it gives us a sense, well, maybe I'll be good enough. Hmm. And so because of my own struggles with it, and then also of what I was seeing in the community and in society, I saw that there was a calling and that I could do this work very naturally.
Wonderful. Yeah. I'm glad that you are doing this type of work because I can see it being a problem for a lot of people, young people in particular.
Yeah, we're seeing it young and all the way up into 60s and mm-hmm. 70s. And we have a very small group of clinicians. There aren't a lot of people who are in this community that work with eating disorders. So we need to have more professionals because we're seeing this epidemic growing and intensifying, and there aren't enough of us that know how to help.
So what happens to those people that are in need, but there's just no place to go at this point?
They struggle quietly without the help, and they may be able to step forward and make some healing steps and defuse from the eating disorder mentality. But basically, that's what we see. That's why we have a increased rates with 30, 40, 50, 60-year-old individuals, because there wasn't treatment for them back, say, 20, 30 years ago. And a lot of people still today, even though there's treatment centers popping up everywhere, everywhere, and IOPs and PHPs and individual counseling, the cost of it, because it's a team effort. You not only have to see a therapist, but you also have to work with a dietitian. You need to often be times working with a psychiatrist. You need to have appointments with your medical doctor. And so it becomes a very expensive treatment model. And the average length of treatment for someone with an eating disorder is 5 to 7 years. Mm-hmm. Mm. So parents remortgage homes.
Wow.
They go into debt in order to help people get the treatment that they want. So many people are left floundering. And another piece of it's very normalized. You know, dieting and restricting and trying to manipulate your body is something that's often looked at as something that's positive. And so it's not recognized sometimes by friends or family that this person truly is struggling with a disease and that they need help. Mm. They look at it as, wow, way to go. You didn't eat today. Wish I could do that. And rather than seeing that as something
that's reinforced,
in society. It's reinforced.
Before we go any further, let's talk about exactly what is disordered eating. Can you give us a clinical definition and then break it down to something that's a little bit more easy to take in?
The clinical definition is connected with the DSM, and it's broken down into several different categories. But basically, it's a maladaptive relationship with food and body that begins to create complications personally, socially, spiritually, and within the family. So I think that it actually is kind of a simple way to see it. It's food is no longer food. Your body is no longer your body. It is something now that you're using to cope and manage life. Hmm. There in the DSM-5, there have been some great changes. We brought in binge eating disorder. And up until now, that has just been looked at as these individuals are overweight. They just need to diet. And we create such shame and embarrassment for individuals with binge eating disorder. So with the new DSM, individuals with binge eating disorder, and just because someone is overweight does not mean they have binge eating disorder. With this new diagnosis, people with binge eating disorder can actually get the treatment and the help that they need. And many treatment centers are creating unique, separate treatment models for the binge eating population. They're not necessarily just mixed in with those with other disordered eating behaviors. And then you see the ones that we know, which are most common, anorexia nervosa, which is the self-starvation. There is restricting type, and there also is binge purge type with that, which confuses some people because if they think that someone is binging and purging, they think they must have bulimia. Then there also is the category of bulimia nervosa, and that is eating large amounts of food, feeling out of control in the short period of time, and then using purging behaviors to get rid of that food, whether that's vomiting, laxatives, diuretics, fasting, running for long periods of time. And then you have the category that most people fall into. It used to be called EDNOS. In the new DSM, they have broken it down, and it's called other specified feeding and eating disorders. It's not as easy to say as EDNOS. Mm-hmm. And with the new DSM, less people fall into this category, which is why they restructured the criteria so that more people could fall into anorexia, bulimia, or binge eating, because those are the categories that insurance companies are more willing to pay for. But majority of us fall into the unspecified because disordered eating is very natural. It is part of our society. Most of us have disordered eating at some time in our life. If somebody passes away and you're grieving and you're not hungry, that is a disordered eating. For many people, that can pass and they step back into more normal eating. And so I think that we often need to look at it doesn't always have to meet criteria to be one of the main categories, to be something that is dangerous and life-hindering.
Marnie, I want to go back to something you said. Yeah. As you were talking about binge eating disorder, which is new to the DSM-5, you mentioned that treatment centers are now creating programming around that. So I was wondering, are the treatment centers waiting for the DSM to categorize certain symptoms into a diagnosis before they create these types of programs? Or is the eating disorder field sort of ahead of the DSM and they're already working with these populations?
I would say from my personal perspective, the community and the centers are farther ahead. Mm-hmm. At Blue Horizon, before the DSM-5 came out, it was being talked about and we were prepared for it. We already had a separate track in the IOP program for binge eating disorder. Mm-hmm. And other places, they had them, they just didn't have enough clients able to come in and afford treatment unless they come from wealthy families, because the insurance companies wouldn't pay. So there might not have been a lot of people in these particular programs, but the programs were already there.
Mm-hmm. And is there, as you mentioned, the programs are kind of far ahead from the DSM. Is there areas where the DSM is lacking, where the community would have wished that there are particular diagnoses to assist with insurance, to assist with, you know, getting grants for programs, et cetera?
I think that the DSM is always evolving, and I don't know if we can ever have the DSM be 100% of what we want it to be. One of the areas that I see is in the anorexia nervosa category, they took out the client having to be experiencing amenorrhea. Because some clients will, because their body is in self-starvation, their body is, the metabolism is shut down and they're starting to store because their body is fearful it's not going to get more. So they do still have their period because their weight is at a place that looks more stable. And in the anorexia criteria, it still makes it sound like you have to be at a weight that is less than what is appropriate for you. And many people who have anorexia walk around and you can't tell. And it's because their body's a beautiful machine. It's shutting down any functions that it doesn't need to be carrying out to just carry out the vital functions. And so that would be a place where I would think we need to even change the wording on that, rather than it needing to be this lower, more kind of drastic weight loss. Mm-hmm. So I think we're improving, but there's always going to be more changes that are going to be evident as we go along.
Great. Thank you.
What's the prevalence? I mean, you talk about how normal this is. It's a part of our society. It's reinforced in our society. What are the statistics, the prevalence of the various types of eating disorders?
The general statistics have been the same for a little bit of time. I think we're going to see new statistics starting to come out. But on an average, there's 30 million Americans that will struggle with disordered eating in a lifetime. And they've broken that down to me, 20 million females and 10 million males. Hmm. And I think that we don't have accurate statistics on either side, because when you go to like a college campus, we were talking about that a few minutes before we started, you're on a college campus, eating disorders are raging on college campuses. But if you ask people if they think they have an eating disorder, they'll say no, because it is just so normalized. So I think that even the female statistics are low. And then males, we're just now really come to a place where we're honoring, and males are stepping forward and having the courage to say, I do struggle with an eating mm-hmm. disorder. But when we look at the sociocultural messages of males, it's not really socially okay for them to say that they're struggling with anorexia or having body image issues. It's not manly, quote unquote. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I think that we have to look at all the statistics with a grain of salt, because I believe the numbers are far exceed what we have in writing. The typical statistic is 1 in 4 women have an eating disorder. I think if we flip that language to disordered eating, we are going to see, this is my own personal statistic that I'm putting out there, but closer to like 3 in 4 women. Mm-hmm. Because of, if you listen and you listen to language, diets is a common talk and wanting to fix and manipulate the body. We see 10% of the overall population are men with eating disorders. Recently, we've seen that the statistics have doubled in midlife over the past over the past probably 5-10 years. So as I already mentioned, women in 30, 40, 50 age range, we're seeing these numbers skyrocketing, partly because there wasn't insurance coverage or treatment centers back then, but also because of the unrealistic ideals that we're putting out there as far as what a woman or a man is supposed to look like at age 40, 50, and 60. Mm-hmm. And then the part that breaks my heart most is how much we're seeing it reach younger and younger levels. The statistic I always throw out that usually shocks people is 9% of 9-year-olds have already thrown up.
Wow.
80 to 90% of children have been on a diet by fourth grade. And 40 to 60% of elementary school kids, so these are our little biddies, are already concerned about their weight. So it's showing how many messages are being internalized by our little ones in our society. And rather than thinking about playing like I did, playing, you know, astronaut in the trees pretending they were my spaceships, they are more focused on their bodies and how they look. And we are sexualizing kids quicker, and we are creating them to be carry on some of the adult worries and fears at such young ages. And that breaks my heart.
That's really sad to hear. Do you have thoughts of where these messages are coming from that's making it reach this young of an age?
These messages are bombarding us. I learned it in grad school, the statistic of we are bombarded with 3,000 to 4,000. And with social media, I think those numbers are now, we'd probably be up to like 5,000, 6,000 messages a day of what is acceptable, what is good enough, how we're supposed to look as a woman or a man. Just the kind of talk that happens in school. Everyone is on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and so we are just you're inundated. When you look at, when I present for the psychopathology class every year, I show them all the images from what you see from Disney princesses and the different male cartoon characters, and everything is about this. Perfection of body and sexualizing even some of these young characters. All the video games now that we're into now, if you really stop and look at these characters and what the body messages are sending, that I don't think we can escape it. And I think sometimes parents and family members don't know what to do. They don't know how to open up that conversation to talk about body love, body acceptance, that you are far more than your body. Your body truly is just your vehicle to get you through life. And that's one of my something that I hold dear to my heart, is really promoting the conversation. We have to be talking and breaking down what kids, young adults, and older adults are taking in all throughout their days.
Wow. You know, I do want to follow up on that some more, because I have a 6-year-old daughter, and I'm constantly concerned about her eating habits. And we try so hard to reinforce just healthy eating habits. But my concern with her is what I see a lot happening that is out of my control, which is people constantly coming up to her and telling her how pretty she is, how cute she is, especially women. I have heard women, older women, adult women, tell her, wow, I wish I had your body. Okay, because she's 6 years old. She's very thin. She's very tight. And so she receives those messages all the time. And I sit there and smile and, you know, and say, thank you. What do you say? Let's see, you know, say thank you.
And
stuff.
cringe at the same time.
At the same time. Because, and then we go home and then we try to reinforce that she's more than her body. She's more than her looks. Okay. And it's hard. Mm-hmm. It's hard. I have seen her at the age of 6 look at herself in the mirror and, you know, and check her body out already. So that's a concern. I definitely want to talk more about that. But I want to just go back a little bit, because you know, you shared these statistics and they're alarming, and you distinguish between eating disorders and disordered eating. If you looked at eating disorders, those are the figures, but if you changed and said disordered eating, the figures would be much higher. And I'm wondering, what is that distinction? What, you know, we have the clinical definition of eating disorder. Absolutely. And, you know, and it's very clear. But then there's those gray areas that I'm thinking disordered eating would be in that people don't think about would be an eating disorder. Can you give us some examples of what that might be?
Yeah, disordered eating is, oh my goodness, it is coming up on, well, we just had it at Rollins College. It's rush. It's time to see if we're going to get accepted into one of the sororities. So what am I going to do? I'm going to limit what I eat. I'm going to do some crash diet plan for the next 5-10 days, or maybe I'm just going to not eat at all. Mm-hmm. And it may not be something that they have a long-term plan, but in order to reach a certain ideal or vision that they have for themselves, they are going to step away from health and taking care of themselves and in many ways punish themselves. Mm. We see that at a time when eating disorders start to intensify is during the spring break time, when everyone's trying to get that perfect stomach and how they're, you know,
that beach body.
Yes. And I forget, one teenager used a term, and I can't think of what it is to this term they use for their stomach, and having the gap, this thigh gap that they talk about. Mm-hmm. And so I think that disordered eating is what we look at with everybody. If you talk to someone and ask them, have you been on a diet? Most everyone will raise their hand. And I think that it's this compulsive idea that we have to diet and fix something quickly. And if we don't, there's something wrong with us.
You know, it's funny because I had a friend visit us the other night, and she was telling me, because we were offering her food, and she said, oh, no. I'm on that 21 pounds in 21 days, or 20 pounds in 20 days. And it's this program, apparently, or it's a challenge that a lot of her friends are being a part of. And it's being circulated through Facebook. So, and I just sat there, I go 20, I think it's 20, 21 pounds in 21 days.
That's dangerous.
Yeah. Very dangerous. That's terrible. How does one even do that?
Yeah.
But yeah, I can definitely see that. And people, you know, you're talking about, spring break and young college kids, but I can see people getting ready for weddings, for example.
Yes.
Oh, I have to fit into that dress or a party or something.
I just take my pants in and have it let out, basically. Each time.
Yeah. But you also mentioned statistics about older people, and we're seeing it more and more older people. Now, you know, I'm in my 40s right now, and I have noticed a big change in my own body and what I'm able to maintain as far as weight. And I find myself now, as I'm in the supermarket, you know, walking through these magazines and seeing these hot bods, you know, these celebrities with the, you know, over 40 hot bods, and seeing somebody like Hugh Jackman and Robert Downey Jr. and Brad Pitt, with these, you know, and they're in their 40s or 50s. I don't know how older than me, and they are just rock solid. And I look at myself and I'm like, what is wrong with me? And I'm feeling that pressure now, whereas I really didn't before, because, you know, I just didn't care as much. But
and
now as I'm
about,
growing older, I'm caring more. And it's interesting that you say that resonated with me.
And to think about, if you didn't have a strong sense of self, how what you just described could create a sense of, I am not good enough as I am. I've got to do something now drastic to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
I truly believe a strong sense of self is what can separate somebody from falling deep into an eating disorder and keeping someone more grounded in self and healing and self-love. But like when you think of people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, say you are divorced and newly divorced, and you're now suddenly out on the dating market, and you're in all this social media and Tinder, which is all about what you look like in that moment, and does someone attracted to you by just what you're posting? And so there's great pressure that they have to fit this mold. And then you look at what we see on TV and all of our desperate housewives and the housewives of this and that, and yeah, I mean, if we all had personal chefs and we had time to have our workouts be a huge part of our day, it would be a little easier to have those ideals, but at the same time, why do we need those ideals? Why do we have to look that way? If we've just had four children and our body is representing that, isn't that representing something that's beautiful and so important in our life? Rather than thinking we have to get rid of this body bulge, which one of the recent stars,
It's a lot of celebrities. Yeah. I know that they're on the front cover of People magazine because I just had a baby and look at my body.
Well,
now.
And then they're getting shamed for not having that body.
Yeah. Or that
week.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Or that happens. Right.
That is such an important piece is shame. Shame drives eating disorders. And then when we look at those that are overweight and don't fit our criteria, the shame that is placed on them, they feel and they internalize that shame. And what is that going to lead to? Some kind of behavior to escape it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important that you brought those words up.
Yeah. As you've been talking, you mentioned, and I'm kind of just thinking about how this disease manifests in people. And you mentioned that there's messaging that could be, you know, society, it could be from family, friends, peers, having a low self-worth when you're receiving those messages. And now having that feeling of shame connected with that. Are there any other pieces that sort of create that perfect storm to move more towards disordered eating or eating disorder rather?
I look at it, the easiest way to explain it and for me to understand it is to break it down into three categories. There is the biological piece. We can't ignore that if you, if a mother is struggling with anorexia, it is 12 times more likely that an offspring of that mother is going to have the chance, I'm not going to say definitely will, but will be demonstrating body image issues and eating disorder behaviors. And if they see things passed down between sisters. And so you have to look at the genetic link. We can't ignore that. But then outside of that, you are looking at psychological factors and then sociocultural factors. Psychological factors are individuals that tend to have that perfectionist tendency. Those that are the humanists, the caretakers, those that tend to everybody else and take on everyone else's stuff or their problems or their pain. Then you're going to look at comorbidities. Is there PTSD? Is there anxiety? Even if it doesn't meet criteria of generalized anxiety disorder, do they have anxiety? Is there co-occurring depression? We also see personality disorders. There is a high correlation of borderline personality disorder connected with anorexia. We do see it connected with bulimia because borderline personality disorder is in response to trauma. And bulimia is highly correlated with trauma. And what they're seeing is that when the dissociation that happens when someone binges and then purging, particularly the purging, is a way to dissociate and escape from the trauma reaction that's happening inside them. So we see the psychological components, oversensitive personality, very delicate, that lack of a real sense of strong sense of self. And then we have to look at the sociocultural issues, which are the thin ideal that is, or for males, it's more of the extreme muscular ideal that we have. We look at abuse. We look at individuals that have had sexual abuse. They may overeat in order to make themselves what they call and they would feel that they would be protected and no one would want to touch them. They would have like a layer of protection. Others may starve themselves so that they never develop into a sexual being because that's dangerous for them. We also see sports. If you typically see a cheerleading squad and a lot of the girls where they want to be is a flyer, the ones that go up in the air and not in every program, but across the board, many of them will be weighing these females before they go out and perform. And if they are not at a weight that coach deems appropriate for them, they will sit the bench. Those girls are going to do something in order to be able to get back out there and do what they want to do, which is fly. So they will manipulate their weight in some way. Dancing. A hard group of clientele that I work with are ballerinas, because it is just part of the dance culture is to manipulate body, this ultra thin ideal, and manipulate food. Then we switch over to something with males. We see wrestling. Wrestling, it is part of the culture to, as they call it, suck weight or drop weight. And they have to do really dangerous behaviors to do that. There was a high school boy in the school next to me where I grew up in upstate New York who died running in those trash bag suits, and up there we have pools inside where it's very hot, and he was running to drop the weight and he had a heart attack. Yet that is part of the wrestling culture. You look at maybe track. A coach with all good intentions says, if you drop 5 pounds, you will cut your 100 hurdle time by this much and you will make it to states possibly. That person loses that 5 pounds, gets wonderful validation and applause and reaches her goal. What if I dropped a little bit more? And as you continue to move in the spectrum of building behaviors, especially if you're starving, you're now malnourished your brain. The prefrontal cortex has no chance to bring logic in, and the brain chemistry starts to shift. I spoke with sat in on a conference by Dr. Tyson up in Elmira last month, and he talked about there's been some studies of when they have had, and they used males in this study, starve them down like Matthew McConaughey was for the recent movie that he was in.
Buyers Club.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is you're doing that. He wasn't doing it in the mindset of an eating disorder. He was doing it in order to play this role.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But as that happens, the brain chemistry starts to shift and eating becomes difficult. They may not have all of the thought process that we may see with someone with a different kind of an eating disorder, but the eating disorder pathology has begun to take place just by simply drastic weight loss, which was for a job and for a beautiful performance, by the way.
Yes.
So I think we have to look at several different categories. And the one that I didn't mention is we have abuse and we think of big T traumas, but there's lots of little T traumas, lots of little someone being teased, someone changing in the locker room. And this happens a lot more when we're younger, and kids teasing. And that kid goes home and then says, I don't ever want to be teased again. So what am I going to do? I'm going to lose that belly that they made fun of. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to look at, there's many different components to create this perfect storm.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it makes me think in the role of a therapist working with this population, there are so many different variables that you need to talk about and assess and kind of look into, that you really need to have some sort of specialization to work with this population. We shouldn't be sending people out in the world as clinicians just to work with this population, thinking they might be able to mm-hmm. work with it in a great way.
Yeah, because it has nothing to do with food. And that's where some people will go to. And it has nothing to do with food. The food is the symptom and the body is the symptom. And the focus is on control. That's the most obvious. That's the one we talk about most. It is about numbing. It is about disconnect from self, from body, from the pain, from others. It is sometimes even about communicating. I have a couple clients, or I've had in the past, where that their eating disorder was a way to communicate to someone that they were angry, that they were hurt. They can't say it, but they can show you. You know, I will show you how much you just hurt me. Now I totally lost exactly where we started off with that question, but.
What I'm interested in knowing as a follow up is, you know, you're saying it's not about food. It's not about food.
No.
It's about control. And I understand that. But, you know, it's interesting when I look at the effects of abuse, effects or the symptoms of depression and anxiety, eating is such a prevalent part
yeah.
of that experience, whether you're either overeating mm-hmm. or you are not eating enough.
Mm-hmm.
But it just seems like eating does something for the person who is struggling, you know, who is struggling with depression, anxiety, who is struggling with self-worth and so forth. Yeah.
Sometimes it pushes those feelings down. With binge eating disorder, they are shoving those emotions down. They may be, you know, sadness, hopelessness, helplessness, disgust. They are pushing them down. Other times it's about separating from anxiety. If they can focus on weight, body, what's happening on the body, body checking, they are no longer connected with whatever was making them anxious. And the interesting thing, so although we say it's all about control, there are a plethora of other reasons why individuals use these behaviors. Something that I haven't done diligence to yet as I've spoken is we're also seeing eating disorders in the LGBTQ community, and they're I was so excited. I met a gentleman named Ryan Salas. I think you all have heard me mention him before. And he was hated the female body that he was in because it was not his true to who he is. And so his way of escaping that body was through self-starvation. So this, it wasn't necessarily, it was in a sense a bit of control, but a way of getting out of a body that did not seem and feel congruent to who he was.
Yeah.
And so I think we have to look at, there are so many different reasons for an eating disorder. And if a therapist that doesn't understand that is just thinking we've got to just focus on control, then we are missing out on so many other aspects. I have many clients who have either affect phobia or have just been so disconnected they cannot feel. And they are scared to death to feel. So the eating disorder is their best friend because it protects them completely from having to sit in any negative emotions. But unfortunately, it blocks out all the positive too.
Are there things that typically individuals do during the day to support remaining within the eating disorder?
They typically, people will isolate. An eating disorder is a disorder that's truly about being alone. You can have an eating disorder and be truly connected because you wouldn't be able to stay engaged with it. So I think you're going to see people who are very focused. Their thoughts are consumed with weight, food, exercise. So you're going to see people skipping out on social events in order to go to the gym. You're going to see people saying, I'm not going to go to dinner with you. I'm going to, you know, stay back because it's not safe for them or comfortable for them, or they would have to eat a meal. You're going to see people who are spending hours on hours on hours at the gym. And yet when they're doing that, people are looking at them. Like I used to spend hours at the gym and people would say, like, wow, look at you, like you are just a powerhouse, not realizing that I was at the point where I was now harming my body and hindering its ability to function. And I think that we see you often see a lot of self-harm behaviors and suicidality, and you also see substance use with eating disorders. And so those behaviors are happening during the day. So basically what the person is doing to support it is disconnecting from every part of life that would truly fulfill them. And they are consumed in a cocoon that is all about the eating disorder. And they have videos. There was a TED Talks that actually showed or played what it sounds like to be in somebody's head with an eating disorder. And it is just screaming of these different parts. I do lots of parts work. I never knew I would do so much part and ego state work with my clients because there's all these different parts screaming and yelling. And the only thing that quiets it down is to do the behavior, because then everything goes numb and everything's quiet.
That's so interesting. You know, as you're talking, I keep thinking about people that I know. I already mentioned a friend of mine who came, did a 21 challenge. I'm thinking about myself and so forth. But, you know, you mentioned people who work out and, you know, exercise. And it brings to mind somebody that I know who is very open about his body dysmorphic disorder. He's not big enough. and he's constantly working out, and he's constantly taking these protein powders, mm-hmm. and he's eating certain types of food that will allow him to be bigger and bigger. And his goal, and he's not a very tall person, but his goal is to be 325 pounds of muscle.
Mm.
So what is the connection, or perhaps the distinction, between body dysmorphic disorder, such as I mentioned, and an eating disorder?
And I think that's important that you bring that up, because when I was going down through the categories, I did leave body dysmorphic disorder. I didn't list that in my grouping of them. And I think that we always have to be trying to assess, is it just body image distress, or is there a more focused and specific aspect of their body that they are so appalled with that they are not seeing with any sort of clear, kind eyes, as I call it. And that takes specialized focus on not just looking at the body, but about what that particular client is focused in and what is that rooted to. And if we're just looking at the body image as a whole, we're going to miss that piece, which is going to guide us to the trauma. As an EMDR therapist, I'm looking for small T's and big T's connected to everything. And if I'm not aware that I need to be screening for body dysmorphia, I am going to miss out on the pathway that is going to take me to the trauma.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and what doesn't work with him at all is people telling him, you're big, you're huge, you're big enough, you're big enough. Don't you see it? Don't you look at yourself?
Well, it doesn't match the voices.
No,
it does not. Yeah. It does not match the voices. And you know, you can put them in front of a mirror and say, look at this. I mean, it doesn't look like a normal body. It just looks like a cartoon, which in fact, it's funny because he does post, he has his own blog. And he talks about his body dysmorphic disorder, and he does post a lot of these cartoons, images, these anime, where the bodies are, the heads are like this, I mean, very small, and the bodies are huge. And he posts, and that's like the ideal for him, you know? And you can't tell him, it doesn't work. It doesn't look good.
No, it really makes me think how isolating this living with eating disorders is, because even imagine when people are talking to him about how big he is, he's not there. He's disconnected from what they're saying because it's not matching what he feels or what he thinks about himself. So even amongst people, it's a very islanded type of experience.
Yeah, but it happens with people who want to be thin, men and women. I mean, you can say, look, we can see how thin you are. We can see your ribs. We can see your collarbone. I mean, it doesn't look healthy. And to them, they can look in the mirror, right? And say, I'm not thin enough.
Because because of the parts, they're not looking at themselves from self.
Yeah.
They have injured, wounded, emotional parts that are in front. I call it being in the front of the living room. And that's the glasses they're looking through. I keep a pair of $2 glasses from CVS near my chair in my office, and I grab them out and I said, I want you to take off the glasses you're looking through, and I want you to put on my clear glasses, and I just want you to have an opportunity to see something different for a moment, because you cannot logically talk someone out of an eating disorder. The prefrontal cortex is not lit up,
which is what people want to do. Yeah. Family and friends, loved
they say,
ones,
just eat.
So let's talk about treatment. Okay. Let's talk about treatment, because we now know that doesn't work. It's not an effective way of helping the person recognize their eating disorder. You mentioned already of some of the treatments, but can you say a little bit more about what is effective and what you do with somebody?
Typically, I mean, the old school main way of treating would be cognitive behavioral therapy. And that is really helping them challenge those distorted thoughts, shifting them on a daily basis, doing that homework from the minute they leave your session till the minute they come back, really challenging, checking for evidence. So all of that is beautiful work. But we've also added on acceptance and commitment therapy, and that takes a little different spin. It's about, we don't have to try to shift all of these voices. What we want to do is enhance self to live towards their values. So they are going to live, if their friends are important to them, and they know that the eating disorder pulls them away from their friends, they are going to hyper-focus on that value of friends. And this chatter that goes on, they almost kind of turn the volume down. It's like having a group of kids in the back seat of the car and you're driving to Disney World and they're screaming and yelling that we want to go here. And you just keep driving.
Right.
It's not about reacting. Mm-hmm. And it's about kind of diffusing from those thoughts without having to do all the work to shift them. We just kind of leave them in the background, and engages a lot of mindfulness and being in the moment. So I am trained in mindfulness. I did the mindfulness-based stress reduction program while here at Rollins. And so mindfulness is interweaved, particularly with learning to be okay in the body, sitting in the feelings, sitting in the body, and learning to tolerate what comes up and to be with it. And then there also is interpersonal therapy.
Wait, can I stop you here? Because the mindfulness piece is very important. And there's a lot of research to support the benefits of living a mindful life. And a lot of that includes meditation, just being aware, being present, and so forth. But I've also heard of mindful eating. Is that part? Mm-hmm. What is that? And is that part of the treatment?
That is part of treatment. And it usually comes later in treatment. Because in the beginning of treatment, we can't allow them to rely on what does my body need right now? What does my body want? We have to do mechanical eating.
Okay.
And they work with a dietitian very closely with that. I stay in my area of expertise and I don't do anything with the food. I refer everything back to the dietitian and they will move them through, you know, eating, eating in threes, so they have three things on their plate, and they'll move them along. But it's very much mechanical eating, blinders on, don't look at anyone else, my plate, my food, my body. And then as they move and they have diffused from the eating disorder script, then we can begin to step into mindful eating and really be, because sometimes at the table at IOP at Blue Horizon, we would be playing games. We would be doing anything to help them distract themselves from those thoughts and those awful things that are being said to them. And there comes a place where we want them to be present and in the moment and notice, am I hungry? Am I full? Is this just emotional hunger? You know, my mom sends me Christmas cookies and I eat like 5, 6, 7, 8 of them. I'm not truly hungry for 8 or 9 of them, but it brings me back to my childhood and my mom. Mm. And I can be aware of that and I can keep it in its place that this is the time when I'm going to eat 8 or 9 and it's not every time that I do that. But I think that that is the goal for most everybody, is to move them to a place of really being mindful with what their body needs and being able to enjoy food and the socialization aspect that comes with food. Because individuals with eating disorders, they may be at the table with you, but they're not there. Mm. They are dealing with so many rapid fire of thoughts that they're not truly connected. It's torture for them to be at a table with people.
Now, as you were talking about that, Marnie, you mentioned IOP, which is intensive outpatient.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned residential treatment before. So it sounds like there's different levels depending on how serious the condition is for the individual where they would seek treatment.
Yeah, there is. There is traditional just outpatient therapy. And like I said, if someone is still pretty symptomatic, we want to make sure we have a well-rounded team. Over time, they usually will begin to space out, maybe see the dietitian every 2 weeks. They usually will see the therapist every week for a little bit longer. Usually, sometimes clients will stick with the dietitian. And then we move to IOP, which is an intensive outpatient program that's being there 3 days a week. It's about 12 and a half hours. They get meal support. They do DBT. They do process group. Mm-hmm. They now do yoga, creative arts. They do before meal processing, after meal processing. They're there to be supported for that hour after the meal when it's really hard to sit with the meal. And then there's a higher level of PHP. That's usually anywhere from 4 to 5 days, depending on, and those are full days that they're there. And then there's also residential treatment and then inpatient. For those that are truly at a risk of medical safety, they are more in a hospital type setting. And then once they begin to refeed, they are then moved to a residential setting. Some clients will go for a month, others will go for 3 months. The difficult part is that an average stay at a treatment center is about $30,000 for a month.
Wow. Yeah. Which is why people go into debt and refinance the mortgage and so forth. Yeah, that you have said so much as far as what is involved in the treatment of this. And it just really shows how complicated this disease is and how serious it is. Now, I want to ask you a question, because I want to go back to what we were talking about with young children. And what tips do you have for a parent of a young child, whether it's a daughter or a son, that would help prevent them from having an eating disorder or disordered eating? Because, you know, we're talking about treatment, but what about prevention?
Yes. Just a quick side note, the other treatments I use are EMDR, just EMDR and brain spotting, but I find EMDR is invaluable and helps move my clients through some of the aspects of the eating disorder and the trauma. So just got to, yay for my EMDR.
Yeah, throw that in there. Yes.
I wouldn't want to be without it. But I think for young ones, I think for parents, for grandparents, for guardians, whether it's dad and dad, mom and dad, single parents, grandparents acting as the attachment figures, it's about modeling. Mm-hmm. I think that so much. I mean, if a kid is sitting and watching dad run from this to this and this to this and never sit down and eat at the table, well, what is that saying about the importance of sitting down and having a well-rounded meal? And so I think really creating that as best as we can, knowing that not all families can do this, but having that family time at the table and really embracing and honoring the importance of feeding ourselves, having healthy meals, and that connection and socializing that comes with it. And I also think it's about modeling body love, body acceptance for yourself, body acceptance for others. If a child hears mom saying, oh, I got to lose this 5 pounds, my thighs are too big, they're jiggling, this and this and this, they are taking in, as you all know, you have kids, they are taking in every single thing that they are saying and thinking, well, then I must need to be critiquing my body. And then I think just looking at food of what it is. It's not about good food, bad foods. It's not about dieting. It's about eating so that your body can be healthy, to have fun, to run and jump, to go to the soccer practice, to go have fun with parents or grandparents or friends. And it's about feeding the body and nurturing the body to do what it can do. And to have that open dialogue. So when the child comes home from school or comes from whatever activity and they talk, you're actually inviting them to share what was the conversation, so you can begin to put accurate information into that prefrontal cortex that's so delicate at that age, giving them the knowledge that they need to be confident in self. And then one last thing is, we don't have to always comment on how somebody looks. Mm-hmm. When my clients do their work with mirrors and they want to put, I'm beautiful, and they want to put all these body things, I said, what about I am smart? Mm-hmm. I am intelligent.
Oh, absolutely.
I am super funny.
Right.
And I'm like, put that on your mirror, because when I look at them, that's what I see. I'm not looking at their body. And I may say, oh, your eyes are just glistening today. And I believe that connects more with the internal person, but I'm not critique or saying anything about how they look, because it's more about the person. And I think if we can be doing that, we're going to get a little ahead of the game.
This is perfect. Thank you so much, because it really affirms a lot of what I'm already doing at home. And it's given me, we do the family meals and we try to get, but it's also.
These episodes are really just for Sam.
It is just for me. This is the only reason why I agreed to do this. But also it's now showing me what I really need to focus on and pay attention to more in this, because I really am concerned about this.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if there are places where parents are getting educated on this.
No, they're not. Parents are not educated on 95% of what parents have to do. A resource that I tell anyone to go to, because now I was a health educator and I used to travel and do these programs for middle school, high school, community. And I tried to give this information, but you can go to the NIDA website. The NIDA website is, and I'll tell you another one in a minute, but the National Eating Disorder Association, they have a parent toolkit. They have all sorts of information, pages upon pages, of how we can really support healthy body and healthy body image and recovery, along with prevention tips. And then there's also the Alliance for Eating Disorders, which is down south in West Palm. Joanna Candell, she works there. She's a big advocate for the Anna Weston Act, which is hopefully going to improve our insurance coverage for eating disorders. But she has a beautiful website with lots of information.
But is this for people who also may suspect that they have an eating disorder and want to seek help, and not just for parents and information.
Okay, absolutely. It is for everyone. Yeah.
Okay, good.
And then locally, you can contact, I forgot to mention this earlier because it's a new role. I'm the new president of the International Association of Eating Disorder Professionals here in Central Florida. It's our chapter. So you could always look up our website and contact any one of us. And then there's also the Eating Disorder Network of Central Florida, which I'm also part of, which, to put in a little plug, on March 13th, we are having our fifth annual Eating Disorder Awareness Walk. And last year we raised $20,000 and gave out $20,000 of treatment scholarships for individuals
amazing.
In our community.
Fantastic.
So, please, you can find all that information online or on our websites. But either
What's
one of those.
What's the website again?
It is EDNCF, Eating Disorder Network of Central Florida. So okay. www.edncf, I believe it's .com, not .org.
Okay.
Or you could Google IAEDP, I-A-E-D-P of Central Florida and find that.
Fantastic.
Well, thank you so much.
Marnie, thank
you're
you
welcome.
So much for
coming.
For joining
yeah,
us.
Yeah, it's been amazing. And, you know, as you've been talking, I'm just imagining how much more this field has to evolve. And we're so happy that you're a part of the community and helping out. And your clients must just feel so blessed and lucky to have you there working with them.
I'm blessed and lucky to be working with them.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I feel like there's so much more to talk about. So maybe we'll have you on again if you.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm always
Thank
up for
you,
it.
Marnie. We really
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you. Yes, very great. And that's the end of another Freudian Quips on WPRK 91.5 FM, the best in basement radio. Be sure to check us out on Facebook and Twitter, where you can connect with the show, and we'll connect right back with you. Until next time, I'm Dr. Palladino.
And I'm Dr. Sanabria.
Be mentally healthy, and word to your edible complex.
Listening to
WPRK
91.5 FM.
The best.
The best.
The best in basement radio.
WPRK.
WPRK.
Yes, it's recording. Okay.